Per Espen Stoknes, welcome to Writer's Voice. So your book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, your book is subtitled Toward a New Psychology of Climate Action. Why do we need a new psychology of climate action?
The main message of climate scientists, activists, and environmentalists have been, pull yourself together, man, or we'll all go to hell. It's been an implicit rehashing of the deeply Christian narrative that we should stop our sinful ways, otherwise we'll burn in hell. They haven't consciously done this, but it is a deep archetypal pattern in our culture, and it evokes a lot of resistance, a lot of guilt, a lot of fear, which generates feelings of helplessness and avoidance. So what we really need is a way of doing climate communications that go with the flow of the human psyche and not against it.
And we need this because in spite of the fact that, you know, most people do believe that climate change is happening and it's human caused, at least in the United States, and I'm sure it's higher in other parts of the world, but they place it pretty low on the priority list for action.
That's correct. Recent figures, for instance, from Yale now in March, shows that more than 80% believe climate change is happening, but only a little bit more than half think it's human caused. And finally, if you ask people to rate their political priorities, climate change typically comes like 19th out of 20, while the top three is always the economy, jobs, and health, for instance. And this is something that I would try to exploit or use more consciously in our book, because fixing the climate problem is really all about creating jobs, creating better health, and realizing the opportunities for innovation in our economy. And this is just by flipping it around, we can align the climate message with people's top political concerns, rather than putting it as yet another thing that people have to worry about.
Why is it that, I mean, it seems that the fear message, fear mongering, works very, very well to convince people to go into a panic over things like Ebola or the threat that your child is going to be snatched off the street. But the possibility that our children will face an uninhabitable climate doesn't resonate the same way. Why is that?
It's really quite simple evolutionary psychology, in the sense that if climate change had a black moustache, carried a big stick, and you met him in some gap corner, you would run like hell. But the problem is that for a fear message to work, it has to be two things. One, a clear enemy image, and two, something we can do about it. Climate change has really neither. If there is an enemy, ultimately it's us. And, you know, attacking that enemy doesn't really make a killing. So also, fear and guilt messages have rarely been coupled to solutions that people perceive as being sufficient in the face of the scale of the problem. So both these things, the lack of an enemy, clear enemy, and the lack of realistic action opportunities has made the fear and guilt message not work in terms of climate.
Well, you know, it's interesting you talk about the lack of a clear enemy, because I think, you know, there is this huge and growing, rapidly growing climate divestment movement, which has sought to make the climate issue one where the fossil fuel industry is clearly positioned as the enemy. And the idea is not so much to demonstrate actual success in destroying the fossil fuel industry economically, but to destroy it on a moral basis. What is your thought about that, and why do you think they've been able to succeed in spite of the fact that they may not fit into the positive message?
By declaring the petroleum industry the enemy, you have given a climate change a face, so to speak, and also by demonizing maybe the CEOs of petroleum companies, you give the climate enemy a face. However much I respect the divestment movement, I really support it from a moral basis, and I'm a bit reluctant to kind of criticize it. It has two major flaws. The first flaw is that divestment doesn't really cut it in terms of hitting where it hurts, because there's this thing about the liquidity of shares. So, you know, at the stock exchanges, shares are bought and sold continuously. So the CEOs of a company that's being subjected to divestment will not notice anything, because the shares that are offered for sale will be immediately picked up by others again, because shares are being bought and sold all the time. Secondly, divesting is not enough unless you reinvest the money in a way that guarantees you it will be used constructively for new climate-friendly investments. And if you just buy shares in another company that's more perceived as more green, again, those funds will not be available for any kind of investments in these companies. Rather, it just contributes to the liquidity of the shares. So if you are to divest, which I support, by all means, you should reinvest in green bonds, because green bonds are loans given to green projects. And in that way, you really help shift the investment structure of the economy. But without that follow-up, it's ineffectual.
And I do want to say, I believe that many in the divestment movement do talk about green investments, maybe not specifically green bonds, but investing in green projects on campus, for example. But yes, so now back to your book. When we try not to think about global warming, one of the things that I found interesting in your book is that you talk about different kinds of psychological barriers in different groups of people. There are those who are conservatives. There are those, for example, you point out in the Tea Party, who are beginning to support, you know, solar energy on a free enterprise basis. So I wonder if you could give us some examples of some of the different kinds of groups, identity groups, and how the climate message is not getting through to them, why, and what needs to happen to turn that around.
So I think climate communications need to be thoroughly rethought about how we reach the different segments in our culture. And as you point out, different segments have different barriers that are their main barrier. And among others, Yale and George Mason University have done great work in segmenting the public in this sense. So what creates this psychological climate paradox is that since about 1990, we've had exponentially increasing scientific documentation about how serious this is, how urgent it is, and how certain we are that human emissions are causing the climate changes we're seeing. So you would believe that after 30,000 articles and 5 IPCC assessment reports, that people somehow would take notice. And in a way, yes, they have taken notice, but the outcome has been the opposite of what you rationally would expect. So actually, in wealthy Western countries today, the concern is lower than it was 25 years ago. So it looks as if the entire science communication effort has achieved the opposite of what it intended. People are less concerned rather than more. The more facts you have, the less concern. And to a rational point of view, that seems inexplainable or complete, you know, an excessively rational point of view. If you're a psychologist, you're not really that surprised, because we know that we are, as human beings, we are full of inconsistencies and paradox all the time. So we say one thing and do the other. We want to be slim and yet we overeat. We see ourselves as kind people, yet we're suddenly more angry than we thought. And in the same way, we like to say we are concerned about the climate. And if you're publicly polled, you perceive now it's politically correct to see you are concerned about the climate. But then if you look at the effect of this concern on your voting behavior or on your purchases, it's fairly low, unfortunately.
I can understand it from another point of view. I mean, I'm one of those people who did respond to the fear message. I can remember the moment in time that I realized that we could be the last civilized generation on the planet. And yet, when sometimes I have to force myself to read another report. I mean, and after all, this is what I think about all the time. To see images of the destruction that we're wrecking is just something I don't want to do, because it's so painful.
Yeah, and when you really get into the depth and not just the cognitive facts, but also let these facts kind of filter through your soul and into your being, as you're describing, the immensity of the thing slowly grows on you. And I write a little bit about the book, in the book, about this sense of deep or a great grief that seems to be prevalent not just in humans but in ecosystems or oceans and dolphins and all growth forests as well. There's this sense that even if you're happy in your life, still when you kind of see the diminished snowpack in the Sierras or experience the dying landscapes of excessive droughts, this grief seems kind of bottomless. And how do you deal with that? How do we live with that? And do we have to shut ourselves off to kind of prepare to survive in the everyday life? Or are there ways of actually letting it flow through us without, shall we say, it becoming so heavy that it locks us in? But can we let it flow through us and break open that numbing? And so we're somehow our hearts are reawakened to a deeper sense of caring. And this is the main topic of the third part of my book, how we can relate to this as individuals, but also as a culture, because we must be careful about not individualizing this problem, because it is really a cultural problem. Even if we feel it personally, deeply personally, we are participating in this larger network and the cultural transition.
Yeah, so if you just joined Writer's Voice, I'm talking with Per Espen Stoknes about his book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. It's a new psychology of climate action. You use different kinds of psychology, evolutionary psychology, cognitive psychology, social psychology, and the psychology of identity in this book. I wonder if you could briefly take up each one and unpack them as to what they can teach us about why we have such a difficulty in confronting climate change and doing something about it.
That's a grand question. You know, I've written different chapters on each of these in order to bring out the multiplicity of perspectives on it. But briefly, evolutionary psychology tells us that we're predisposed to short-termism in the sense that it's better to have a bird in the hand than 10 on the roof. And we're also predisposed to imitate others and chase for status, as well as we're, shall we say, genetically programmed to overemphasize vivid and dramatic threats, but underplay slow-moving and less salient ones. So some people are making this argument that we are, as humans, hardwired to kind of self-destruct ourselves on the planet with it. And I tend to disagree to that, because you're taking a very deterministic and reductionistic view of how humans function, because we're not just genes, we're also culture. And there are so many, actually most cultures on this earth, historically speaking, have been more sustainable than this one. So there are so many ways to, shall we say, modify or shape these old mind, old body patterns into a more constructive way that leaves us with a huge range of options. So how we think about these things and how we mold them into social norms is more important in our time than the genetic makeup in itself. Even though I think it's very good to know about it, because we can then maybe leverage these old patterns into our new strategies. And that's what I'm trying to do. How can we rethink the way we make frames and conditions for behavior that are aligned with our deeper evolutionary nature, and don't try to control or stop it, or because that only backfires, like even good old Sigmund Freud so clearly showed.
Could you give an example of how to use the evolutionary psychology to craft the climate message?
Yes. Maybe the easiest to show is our need for status, because we like to compare ourselves to others, and that's a major determinant in how happy or how successful we feel. So rather than comparing yourself in terms of income or square feet of your house, you could realign the information around you. So you could compare yourself to your power consumption, for instance, with the average of your neighbors. Or you could compare your water consumption with the average of other people in your state. And by using social media apps and social norms, you could make it meaningful for people to participate. And they would use their old need for status and competition and also imitation to further change our, shall we say, overconsumptive habits from the 20th century. That's one example. So there, evolutionary psychology kind of merges with behavioral economics and what I explore is also in the book as nudging, how we can apply nudging to create automatic, mindless, but green behaviors.
Okay, so then cognitive psychology.
Cognitive psychology sounds very, you know, academic maybe to a lot of people. Cognition really just means thinking. And cognitive psychology likes to use often computer metaphors for how we think. So they talk about cognitive schemas and processes and information processing and this kind of thing. What's very important takeaways from there is this capacity we have in our thoughts to distance ourselves from the climate issue. Somehow, the climate issue doesn't hit these evolutionary buttons we have by itself because it's distant in time. Scientists typically talk about the year 2100. And it's distant in space because the dominant imagery in the news media has been glaciers and arctics and drowning polar bears and people drowning in the Pacific or blown away by cyclones. So it seems to be far in the future, distant in space, and also distant socially. It always affects somebody else. It's never, you know, like me. And finally, it's also somebody else's responsibility. So it's way beyond my scope of influence. So in all these senses, climate gets somewhat ghostly or not really there. And CO2, of course, is invisible. It's not toxic. So there are very few cognitive hooks that makes us feel a sense of urgency in the climate topic itself. So you could say maybe it's hard to envision a problem that would be so difficult to grasp for our thinking as a slowly accumulating set of CO2 in the atmosphere, which we cannot see, we cannot smell it, and it seems utterly unreal, yet we're told all the time it is very real.
And you have a wonderful example of how to make it more cognitively real in the book. I think I'll just read this because you express it so well. You say, let's imagine that CO2 is a brown haze, heavier than air. All CO2 thus falls down to Earth and creates a blanket layer, a pool around us that we're swimming in. How high would this layer be if spread evenly out all around the world? It used to be around 15 feet before the Industrial Revolution, but humans have now added around 7 extra feet. So we're now immersed in a dense 22-foot-high fog all over the world. I just love the way you frame that.
The trouble has been that climatists, scientists, are typically speaking in terms that are utterly incomprehensible to the general public, such as PPMs or such as watts per square meter, which is the forcing of this. And when you use that highly abstract way of reasoning, you're assuming that people have at least 7 to 8 years of studies of the physics and chemistry of climate change. So even if 350.org is a cool name, still it refers to realities that are comprehensible maybe to just 10% of the population. And this is what I'm trying to address. How can we engage viscerally imagery that is goes with the way we naturally think? And that's part of this new psychology of climate action.
Now, the two we haven't talked about are social psychology, although I think we did to some degree, and also the psychology of identity, because I think that's very interesting. You know, there are evangelicals, for example, in the United States who totally get it about the climate, who talk about the fact that we have a responsibility to God's creatures, that, you know, they speak about things in a Christian and evangelical terms. And yet it does seem that, you know, if you believe in climate science, you're saying that you're some kind of Marxist. You know, one of your chapters is climate science and new Marxism.
Yes, I've seen that, climate change won't cause a catastrophe because Jesus will come back before the catastrophe happens. And of course, what this exposes is to what extent we are all living inside different myths. For us that do not live inside the evangelical myth, we live maybe within a scientific myth where we believe that science explains everything that's worth knowing. So we get into this religious dimension where you're really having a conflict of narratives, even if you believe you are arguing about science, which is typically agnostic in its nature.
How do you break open the carapace that protects people because they have a certain identity that they think climate science doesn't enter into it? How do you break that open to reach them with their values?
Some of the problem has been, a monotheism of story where the scientific narrative has had, a monopoly, at least in the minds of some communicators. We have the right story. So I believe that the future of climate communication with the diversification of these narratives into four or five, at least, main categories, main types of narratives that all make meaning for different segments of the population. So one I explore extensively in the book is the story of smarter economic growth or green growth or whatever you want to call it, where we recognize that in order to serve the 7 billion people we already be and up to maybe 9 in 2050, we need to switch from improving labor productivity, which we had done in the 20th century, to resource efficiency or resource productivity in this century. And that's simply smart economics. We can't use more than one planet. That's what we have. So we have to create more value with the resources we actually have. And the good news is that it's perfectly doable, it's profitable, and we can continue our economic system if we transition the structure within it quickly enough. And a lot of driving forces are going that way. So this is an economic narrative. And I see it emerging all over the place. For instance, in the report that came out last autumn, which is called the New Climate Economy Report, which fully supports this from an economic point of view. Others, however, are not that economically minded or not that commercially or growth oriented. So we need other stories. For instance, the story of rewilding, which is the story of how we can shape our cultures more like maybe some of the First Nations had, where their way of living actually enhances and improves the quality of the ecosystems around them. How can we get ecosystems thriving again? Because we know we live off them, so why not live well together with them? And there's this very broad movement coming up in Western culture, particularly that I know about, of how can we get the big carnivores back, the old growth forests back, making the rivers clean again, getting beavers into the rivers where they have been driven to extinction. So we recognize that we are not fully human unless we also have a more than human thriving world around us, which is a very good story, I think, which reaches a lot of other people. Thirdly, we have the religious community. And luckily, I saw now that the Pope just issued a text. I'm not Catholic, so I don't know the technical details. I probably will learn it, which is that the proper role of humanity is to be stewards, or having the stewardship of God, of the planet, on behalf of God. So what we're seeing, which is really fascinating, is that kind of broad change in all the major religions of the world through to recognizing that it's unethical to destroy the nature around us in the same way that it's unethical to kill other people. And this very powerful religious reframing or the religious story alone also has an ethical or atheistic view to it. And then very often what is used is the ethics of the unborn generations. So how do we give voice to the generations that will follow after us? Will they accuse us of being very unethical in terms of our destruction of the planet now? Who will speak out for the rights of those yet unborn? Which is by itself, you don't need to ground that in a narrative of God, but you ground it in the narrative of morals and ethical obligations to those who have no voice in our current conversation.
As you're speaking, all of these are powerful and important narratives, although there is some controversy over the idea of growth, that can we even have green growth, that we also need to, in a positive sense, put in non-material benefits to supplant some of the material consumption patterns that we have. But the question that I have is that you said before that many cultures have been more sustainable, previous cultures, than we have. And the difference, I think, really is predatory capitalism, just to put it right there. We run on an economic system, and I know you're an economist and you work with businesses, and I have studied economics and worked in the business field as well. But I have a deep appreciation for the systemic drive towards profits over other values. And I always come back to this question. This is a fundamental question around climate, because we're going to have to put other values ahead of profit, because profit is not always going to be served. Certainly not profit in the sense that business looks at it, which is in the short-term sense. But even perhaps in the long-term sense, we are going to have to privilege other goods, other benefits, over economics to a certain degree at certain times. We have to allow that possibility. And we have a system that right now doesn't.
To be sure, I completely agree that our current economic structure, as we have inherited it from the 20th century, chases a type of suicidal growth, to use an even stronger word than you're using. Yet, I'm positive and optimistic in terms of what commerce and industry and value creative activities can achieve. So I also think that business and corporations are among the highest expressions of human ingenuity and creativity that we have ever witnessed in the history of humanity. So, as you said, it is an issue of how do we balance the different values within the economic system. And there is a prejudice among, shall we say, what the conservatives would call the leftists and the liberals, that profit is evil. And I tend to disagree. I prefer to call it value added or value creation, which is that when people do things smarter, they can share the value with others that they are trading with, which is the fundamental sense of how you add value in society. You make something that other people find good, and they give you extra value to do that. Now, the issue is, there's also a perception that profit rules out other values, but there is nothing really in the structure of business which requires this. So both boards, shareholders, and management are really free to balance these profit with other concerns, other values, if they want to. There's been this perception that management may be fired or legally sued if they don't give priority to profits, but that's not a legal requirement. It's a social norm prevalent among certain financial analysts. So I've been discussing this extensively with legal experts, and fortunately, businesses can give priority to other values, shall we say, a balance of values alongside a profit. And what I've been looking at is how easy it is and how smart and how profitable it is to actually waste less. Because in the 20th century, we had the growth of an industry that thrived on falling resource prices and falling energy prices. So they built up this hugely, insanely wasteful practice of burning off oil, burning off gas, burning off mining resources, and just throwing everything at landfill. So this recognition starts from how meaningful it is when 7 billion people are aspiring a middle-class living standard, it is to achieve much more while using much less. And this is not against profit. I think profits are perfectly alignable with building a smarter, more resource-productive economy.
And I agree with you. It's a question of balance or seeing the I understand what you're saying. You actually create more value by using less. Yet let's look at the California drought, which many people do think has something to do with climate change. There's a growing movement against Nestle, the water bottlers, because they are basically capturing a huge amount of what water is left in order to sell it at a profit to consumers. So this would be an example where Nestle, which actually is very conscious of recycling, has a huge recycling push, which I've written about in other places, and a very genuinely impassioned embrace of recycling, is still coming up against a public that's saying, basically, you're taking a public good and privatizing it for your needs. I think these kinds of conflicts are going to increase. And this may be a little bit off of the topic here, but I think it adds a granularity to the discussion.
Yes. This is, in a way, the new psychology of climate as it applies to businesses and commercial actors. And I think Nestle, driving huge trucks, heavily loaded trucks with water bottles, thousands of miles back and forth while burning fossil fuels is an insane business model from an ecological point of view. So it really depends on how Nestle would understand their business model. Now they can transport those bottles using more energy efficient trucks, or using refrigerators to keep that water cool while using less energy. But that's like scratching the surface, right? So what you really need to do is to move from that, what I call the house cleaning level, up towards a more product portfolio level, where you really look at how sustainable are our products, and finally, how sustainable is our business model as such. So why doesn't Nestle reinvent itself as having new products? So you would sell or help people conserve water and develop their own drinking water equipment that is low in energy and uses very friendly materials. And you could still make money by giving people clean, safe, well-tasting water, but then based on a much more decentralized and localized business model. Why isn't that fully possible? And if Nestle doesn't do it, somebody else will, and they will be out of business, just like Kodak was when the digital camera came.
We're talking with Per Espen Stoknes about a new psychology of climate action. His book is What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. I found this a very readable book. It was an inspiring one as well. You really break down some of the framing that we've been using that hasn't been working, and you contrast it with other kinds of framing that could work. For example, you talk about, we've talked about disaster. Climate change is the destruction of the environment. It creates tremendous uncertainty. It's going to be very costly to deal with it. There's going to be a high price we have to pay and a lot of things that we have to lose and sacrifice in order to deal with it. What are some of the positive framings that you use with that? I mean, for example, you talk about risk and insurance instead of disaster.
Yes. Most of us have fire insurance, but usually it's not because you really think your house will burn down. Still, it might happen. So people are willing to spend quite a lot of money on insuring their house because it might burn down. And this really is a type of institutionalization of a long-term thinking that I think is quite admirable. And so on the average, we use between 2-3% of the GDP in fire and theft insurance for our property, our assets. And in the light of this, why not employ the same framing, the same institutionalized structures, and seeing the investments in climate-friendly technologies as a type of climate insurance? So what are we willing to pay today in order to avoid the possible burn down of our planet? And this is a much more constructive way of talking about it, rather than arguing, is it uncertain? Is it not uncertain? How certain is it? We could just employ this because we're used to thinking about risk in this way. Also, the terms of defense. Most countries have a national defense and spend about 2-3%, I think America is higher than that, of their GDP on the defense. Why do we do that? Because do you think our country will be invaded? Well, not really, but still, like in Norway, we keep up that because it might happen. Conflicts might happen again. And that's a public good to have a safe, secure country. And when we look at really what's needed in terms of climate insurance, it's very little. It's much less than what we spend on defense. It's much less than what we spend on fire insurance and theft insurance. So it really should be just common sense. We spend a tiny, tiny fraction of our public and individual money in terms of contributing to a climate insurance. And that takes away a lot of the debate. And I think the project Risky Business, that was spearheaded by both the Republican Paulson, Hank Paulson, Bloomberg and Tom Steyer, is a brilliant initiative. Unfortunately, they too have succumbed somewhat to this apocalyptic mode where there is, you know, they use this image of the roller coaster that was swallowed by Sandy, and they speak about, you know, the existential threat. But framing it as just plain, pure common sense to pay that insurance in the same way that we need theft insurance and fire insurance and defense insurance, that puts it into a different mode altogether. And we get out of this endless debate that economists have been so fond of in talking about how costly it is and how many jobs it will take away. It doesn't really. It's not costly, and doesn't take jobs away. But again, if you say it's not costly, then you're still within the cost frame. So what I want to really is to move it outside the discussion of costs into an insurance frame where we pay according to the risk we're exposed to. So the risk framing is important, but there are also other framings that are very conducive. And one that's growing hugely is the health framing, because we know that with increasing temperatures, we'll get more heat strokes, more heat-related violence, and increasing CO2 disproportionately increases the amount of pollen. So we have much more pollen and also asthma, and quite a few of the emission sites also create huge amount of respiratory diseases, particularly asthma, and they disproportionately hit the poor and those that have lower access to health services. So climate is really about the health of people. We shouldn't do it because of the year 2100 or because otherwise we'll burn in hell, but we do it because it's part of our health to have a clean, fresh air and a stable climate that doesn't kill us with new bugs, new diseases, much more pollen, and give people daily sufferings, I would say, yeah. So how can we rethink the climate issue as something that concerns the health of our family, of our communities, and not something that is we do because we are going to stop the polar bears from drowning or because our Antarctica is melting or something? That brings it home to people. So all these barriers, defenses that make us keep climate change at a distance, when you talk about the health effects and all the joy we have in breathing a clean air, that brings it home to your doorstep, so to speak.
Per, you talk in your book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming, is the power of stories. And I was grappling with this idea of the doom and gloom is a turnoff. And yet, I think a lot of times also the positive stories only appeal to certain small segments. You know, businessmen want to hear positive stories about green business, and community activists want to hear positive stories about community action. But to really get the message out there, people seem to respond more to stories of confronting terrible challenges, you know, great disaster and tragedy, and overcoming that. And I wonder if you have an idea of some of the stories or the way to approach stories that can grasp both the fear aspect and the inspiration aspect.
Yes, I think you need a sense of shadow or suffering in the stories as such. However, it's a huge difference between a story that kind of wallops or kind of endlessly turns around the suffering and the compared to a story where this is overcome, as you say, by some action or discovery. And the archetypal story you're tapping into then is something that resonates deeply with all of us, and it's called the heroic story, or the, as Joseph Campbell called, the hero with a thousand faces. And it's really a story of transformation. because you have this sick king or you have this princess that's been lost and it's taken by the monster. And then there's this resistance to leaving home, resistance to entering into this dangerous territory. Yet finally you do that. And then on the journey you meet certain helpers, and then there's a huge troll or a monster, and somehow with this magical help you get from the helpers or some magical gem, you somehow bypass or win over those hurdles and the monsters and return home to society with a renewing gift. And this story is repeated and replayed by, as you say, with individuals who have their homes crushed, thinking also about all the stories we have from Katarina and New Orleans, also by the business people who are creating new sustainable business models. So I think by consciously being aware of the transformational power of this, the hero's journey story, we can apply it much more constructively. And then you need to apply both characters and situations that the different cultural sub-identities will identify with. And this hero's journey story, I would also I have great belief in that. If we could replace that catastrophe or apocalyptic story with it. Also, if we're speaking imaginatively, I don't really, as this is that skeptical of the apocalyptic story. Actually, I've written an article on the benefits of apocalypse. But then what we have to recognize is that the apocalypse is not a literal apocalypse, like a certain date into the future where everything is going to crash. Rather, what we're talking about is that something in me or something in our culture is dying right now. So how can we see this story about hell or doom or disaster as speaking to a certain part of me or our culture that has to die because its time has run out? And in that sense, we're addressing death and ending as something that is part of our life cycle, because you know, the only way to renew life truly is through death. And you can also see life as a series of small deaths along the way. You part from your old home, you part from your old friend, you have to part from your old role, and maybe you have to leave your old marriage or, you know, all these relations. And they are in a way small deaths, small endings. And if we could reimagine apocalypse as speaking to, it's the old, shall we say, industrial, rational, superior control mode of being in the world, that is what has to die. So apocalypse is really speaking to a certain mindset that has to succumb, that has to end for something else to be born. And speaking about apocalypse in this mode, I'm all for. So let's sing the song of apocalypse, but don't be literal. Don't take it into a kind of mind-numbing closing. We have to maybe combine that sense of an ending with a hero's journey. So there's some kind of rebirth or reshaping or transformation at the end of it.
Well, that's wonderful. And so is your book, What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. Per Espen Stoknes, thank you so much for this really wonderful in-depth conversation about a new climate psychology.
Thanks. It's been wonderful talking to you. And having this kind of in-depth conversation has been really inspiring for me as well. So thank you.